We're going to go ahead and get started. Oh, my watch is really helpful. Okay. Actually, we're going to wait 2 minutes and start on time. I'm a little ahead of myself, so among yourselves, right? The next group, group two, continuing in the orthopedic theme, and I did try to group these, will be presenting on physical therapy exercise interventions in tendinosis injuries. And their supervisor in the back, Dr. Linda Lee, who they just told me has given them amazing support, and I'm not surprised. And the presenters for this topic are, I'm not going to even try the last name, so it's lucky if I can get the first names, Paul, Cleo, Aslan, Mark, did I get that right, Aslan? Oh, I would just start again. Paul, Cleo versus Cleo. It's Cleo. Paul, Cleo, Aislinn, Margaret, and Michelle.
We would like to start our presentation today by thanking all of you, particularly faculty and clinicians, for taking time out of your day to support us by attending today's presentation. On that note, I would like to introduce to you our systematic review, which examines tendinopathy and the effectiveness of eccentric exercise. And as Dr. Harris mentioned, our group comprises Paul, Aislinn, Michelle, Cleo, and Maggie, myself. The overview for today's presentation includes a description of the purpose and introduction, which I will give, methods, which Cleo will explain, results in discussion, which Aislinn and Michelle will describe, and Paul will conclude with our clinical relevance and future research. So the purpose of today's presentation is to systematically review the current evidence and determine the effectiveness of eccentric exercise in the treatment of chronic tendinosis. To begin our introduction, I would like to define tendinosis. Tendinosis is a non-inflammatory intratendinous collagen degeneration without clinical or histological signs of inflammation. The most common tendons affected include the patellar tendon, the Achilles tendon, as well as tendons of the medial and lateral elbow and the rotator cuff. The prevalence of tendinosis is widespread. For example, 40 to 50% of elite male volleyball players suffer from patellar tendinosis. In the general population, lateral epicondylitis has an annual incidence between 1 and 3%. As well, competitive tennis players have an incidence as high as 40% in their wrist extensors. And elite and recreational runners suffer from Achilles tendinopathies, which account for up to 9% of injuries. As well, overuse injuries, including tendinopathies, account for nearly 7% of all injury-related physician office visits in the United States. Common causes of tendinosis include aging, microtrauma, vascular compromise. As well, the common population that's affected includes competitive and recreational athletes, as well as people in occupations that consist of repetitive tasks or manual labor. The recovery times with treatment varies, and this tends to vary with the length of presentation. For example, if it's an early presentation, treatment times or recovery times will be between 6 and 10 weeks, versus a chronic presentation can be upwards to 3 to 6 months. Tendinosis differs from tendinitis, as shown in the slide here. I'm going to try to use the laser. Boom, boom. If this is a normal tendon, look at the abnormal tendon. There's an increase in cellularity with fibroblasts and myofibroblasts, an increase in vascularity and ground substance, as well, and this is the big one, it's collagen disorientation, disorganization, focal necrosis or calcification. Look at these arrows, boom, boom. As well, there may be with or without neovascularization and fiber separation. And probably the biggest point being there's an absence of inflammatory cells. Currently, the conservative treatment include ultrasound, laser, deep friction massage, orthotics and braces, corticosteroids, mobilizations and manipulations, thermotherapy, cryotherapy, rest, acupuncture, pulsed electromagnetic field therapy, and eccentric exercise. By definition, eccentric exercise is the active lengthening of a muscle under force. This is accomplished via the lowering phases of exercises, such as, and I will call upon our fill-in Vanna, the decline squat, the eccentric calf lowering, as well as a wrist extension. And these are sort of the three main exercises that were found throughout the literature. Introduction-wise, throughout the literature, tendinosis, literature indicates that eccentric exercise training leads to an increased net collagen synthesis in the tendon tissue through constant overload of the tendon. As well, it has been established that about 12 weeks of eccentric exercise training normalizes tendon structure and decreases tendon thickness in the Achilles tendinosis. As such, the rationale for conducting our systematic review is because the literature shows that eccentric exercise has promise for treatment of Achilles and patellar tendinopathies. Therefore, our goal was to review the literature to examine the effectiveness of eccentric exercise as a treatment for tendinosis. Okay, I'll turn it to Cleo.
So, methods. As Maggie mentioned, we defined or formulated our research question. So the next stage of our methods was to use the PICO paradigm to focus on essential elements and select our terms. So this is our PICO. So P stands for population or patients. So for us, we defined our population as patients diagnosed with a tendinopathy. So this was either a clinical diagnosis through a clinical exam, the use of MRI or ultrasound, or they could also have a chronic tendon or a chronic tendon pain lasting more than 3 months, and adults over the age of 16. I, which stands for intervention, we were solely interested in eccentric exercise and limited our study to this. C is comparison, and we did not include any comparison for our review. O represents outcomes, so the outcomes we were interested in were pain, range of motion, return to functional activities, the avoidance of surgical intervention, strength, and tendon structure and healing. So after using the PICO method, we were furthering our search strategy. So we decided on several databases that we would search, and we searched the most current databases available. So we looked at Embase, CINAHL, Medline, Pedro, the Cochrane Library, as well as Sport Discus. We also did hand searching of journals, and we mainly focused on physiotherapy and physical therapy. And we actually went back to 1985, so we searched all table of contents. Because of the discrepancy between tendinitis and tendinosis over the past, we figured it was prudent to go back that far and see if there was any past research that was, they may be put under the title of tendinitis, but was more key to tendinosis given the actual disease process. So we also reviewed all reference lists of the journals that we read, as well as review journals. We examined our personal libraries for any extra articles that might be there, and we also communicated with several experts, and one being a doctoral candidate at UBC of Michael Ryan, who's actually doing his PhD on tendinosis. So the main search terms we came up with, because of the discrepancy of tendinitis and tendinosis in the literature, we broadened our terms to include tendinopathy, tendinosis, tendon disease, and tendon injury. And then we included some terms such as Achilles, swimmer shoulder, patellar tendon, golfer's elbow, rotator cuff, jumper's knee, and eccentric exercise. And the following table just shows you our search term and search strategy. And Charlotte Beck was very helpful in coming up with the search strategy, which could basically be easily applied to all the databases, which was great. So on from there, we came up with our inclusion and exclusion criteria. So some of them I've already mentioned. We limited our study, of course, to human subjects, and we decided on an age of 16 years or older due to the nature of the pathology. So they had to have a clinical diagnosis of tendinopathy or, like I mentioned, tendon pain that lasted greater than 3 months. And this was kind of standard in the literature. We also limited our study to English due to the financial aspects involved with translating articles. And again, we focused on eccentric exercise. Exclusion-wise, concurrent treatments were excluded if patients had surgical intervention or if the tendinosis was caused by an injection of a sclerosing agent, which has been done in the past too. And we also limited our study to randomized control trials as well as clinical control trials. So further in our study selection, so we ran our search strategy on our databases, and we then conducted a screen of title and abstracts, and we selected our studies based on our inclusion criteria, and we used a two-person independent review process like everyone else, and we had to come to consensus. Then the included articles, based on title and abstracts, the included articles were recovered for full review, and full review was allocated randomly between two people, and again, it was independently reviewed, and consensus was achieved through discussion. So the data extraction process. Dr. Linda Lee was very generous in giving us a data extraction form that she'd used on previous projects. So we actually piloted this form to see if it was applicable to our purpose and if we were actually suitable to the form. So we took 10% of our retrieved articles and tested the form. So we had 89.6% agreement based on 115 variables. So this basically suggested that the form was suitable to our purposes and that we were utilizing the form well. But we actually went on to make a couple changes to increase our accuracy and clarity and consistency. So the main data that we extracted many variables on study description, participant description. We spent a fair amount of time on study quality rating, and then we also collected baseline and post-treatment outcome measurements, as well as dropout and adverse effects. So we also used the Van Tolder 2003 quality assessment tool, and this tool was based on 11 internal criteria that we rated as yes, no, and unclear. And one of the outcomes of our study was that we realized we would probably expand our quality assessment tool. This was a very limited tool given the types of studies that were conducted. And so if we were to repeat our project, we would probably utilize a different one, which we were exposed to. But that was a big learning process for us. So the methodological criteria, again, were independently assessed by the two reviewers, and consensus was reached by discussion. We also came up with a ranking system of our studies. We decided on high versus low quality studies, and we arbitrarily decided the cutoffs for high and low. And so for us, our cutoff, this was basically based on certain number of our studies didn't meet criteria, and that will be discussed later. But so we decided on high quality would be any studies that met 6 out of the 11 criteria, and low quality would be any studies that scored 5 or lower on the Van Tolder criteria. And like I mentioned, what we found out is less than 1/3 of the studies actually fulfilled all of the criteria. And the criteria that generally were not fulfilled were adequate treatment allocation of concealment, blinding of patients, and blinding of the care provider. This was just not consistent. I think it's just given the type of studies that are conducted. So, and less than 1/2 of the studies were blinded to the outcome assessor and to the intervention or had accessible compliance. And Van Tolder stipulates acceptable compliance as 70% in all groups. So those were some major shortcomings of all the studies that we looked at. So how we synthesized all this information that we were gathering. So what we did was a standard means difference, and we used Hedges G, which basically incorporates the standard deviation of the studies as well as the sample size. So we looked at basically differences between the treatment and the control or comparative treatment to come up with a ranking. And then we used best evidence synthesis. So this is a method that you can use to rank your findings, because we had all this information, but we had no way to really synthesize it. So this best evidence synthesis is a method to do that. So you can use this method and you can come up with rankings of either strong, moderate, limited, indicative, or no evidence. And best evidence synthesis utilizes the study design, so whether or not the study was a randomized controlled trial, clinical controlled trial, or other design, utilizes the study quality, which is why we ranked our studies as either high or low, as well as the statistical findings. And you utilize these three things to basically come up with a ranking of the evidence. So we could not do a meta-analysis, so this was the alternative.
Okay, so I'm going to take you through the results that we came up with. As was mentioned, we started with 201 citations, and we narrowed this down to 16 relevant articles. This is just a visual of how this process came about. There were 6 databases that we searched and came up with 201 articles. From there, duplicates were excluded, which excluded 91 articles. Then, with the additional 110 articles, we did a screen based on the title and abstract, and we excluded an additional 80 articles from there. So we had 30 articles to obtain for a more detailed full-text evaluation. At this point, we also added an additional 15 articles, and these were based on our personal libraries, as was mentioned, reference lists of relevant articles, and hand searching. So we had 45 articles at that point. From there, we excluded 29 articles, and these were based on different criteria, as I've listed. 18 studies were not a randomized control trial or a clinical control trial. 8 studies failed other eligibility criteria that we'd set out. Specifically, 1 study didn't end up having an eccentric exercise intervention at all. 1 study was in a language that we were unable to translate, and 1 study we just couldn't track down after extensive searching for it. So again, we had 16 articles, 12 were randomized control trials, and 4 were clinical control trials. So now I'd like to just briefly try to summarize all of our 16 studies. We had 6 studies that dealt with the patella tendon, and the age range for these studies was 22 to 31, the age range of participants. It was younger than the other groupings of studies, most likely because many of these studies were on elite university volleyball players, so they tend to be younger. 7 studies were on the Achilles tendon, and the age range was 39 to 51. And we had 3 studies that dealt with wrist extensors, and the age range was similar to Achilles at 38 to 47 years. Our studies were very heterogeneous as well, but I'll try to sort of give an overview of different characteristics. The eccentric exercise intervention, there was a variety of exercises. Many studies did use an Alfredson protocol, which we will discuss a little bit later, and although some did not. And some of the protocols had patients exercising through moderate amounts of pain, but it was variable as to how they decided what was moderate. The comparative treatments of the studies were things like concentric exercise, use of a night splint, stretching, shockwave therapy, TENS, ultrasound, deep tendon friction massage, or a wait and see control. The duration of symptoms ranged anywhere from 3 months to 41 months. The duration of intervention could be as little as 4 weeks or as great as 24 weeks. And number of participants in each study was as small as 15 to as large as 124. And then the types of participants that the studies dealt with, there were 4 studies that dealt with recreational athletes, 5 studies looked at competitive university volleyball players, and the rest of the studies were a more general population. Okay, so onto our outcome measurements. We grouped our outcome measurements at the International Classification of Function. So the outcomes we were interested in under body function and structure had to do with pain and strength. Under the activity level, we looked at functional assessments and questionnaires, such as the Victoria Institute of Sport Assessment Questionnaire, mostly used for the patella tendon for the knee, the foot and ankle outcome score. We looked at pain-free grip strength as well as just regular measure of grip strength. Also the disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand, and other global assessments and performance assessments. Under the umbrella of participation, we looked at quality of life questionnaires and return to sports status. Okay, so as mentioned before, we ranked our studies as high or low quality. So this is just a look, a breakdown of what we had. Of our 12 RCTs, 7 studies were rated as high quality, and the range of scores was between 6 and 8. 5 of our studies rated as low quality, ranging from a score of 3 to 4. With our clinical control trials, we had 1 study rating high with a score of 7, and 3 rated as low quality with scores between 2 and 5. Okay, as mentioned, we calculated standard mean difference scores between the eccentric intervention and the comparative treatment. And standard mean difference is just a measure of effect size. Unfortunately, we could only calculate the standard mean difference on 9 of 16 studies due to lack of data, of proper data reporting. We did attempt to contact a number of the authors to try and obtain additional data. Unfortunately, we weren't able to obtain any more data. So we did this with 9 studies, and then we applied these findings to a best evidence synthesis model. So now what I'd like to do is I'd like to take you through the significant findings that we found with our standard mean difference comparisons. And I'll attempt to use this laser pointer, we'll see. So I'm going to talk by study. So the Alfredson study, oh dear, here we go. Told you.
What did you pass?
I'm not sure.
All right. So this is what you use, laser.
Okay, I think I hit the wrong one.
Okay.
I must be nervous. Okay. Oh, I did it again. So
okay.
Source again.
So source again. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So the source. Let's see.
Maybe.
Can I take
okay.
a look once again?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. We'll see. Okay. So Alfredson, the Alfredson study was rated as a low quality study. It did have significant findings here for pain. So basically the eccentric intervention showed a greater decrease in pain, a significantly greater decrease in pain than the comparative treatment. Also for strength findings, this study looked at 3 different measures of strength using an isokinetic dynamometer. And the third measure of strength was significant. That was an eccentric contraction strength at 90 degrees a second. The other 2 measures were of concentric strength, so it makes sense that if you're doing eccentric intervention, your eccentric strength is going to increase. And it did over the comparative treatment. The next study here is Romp et al. Was a randomized control trial. This we rated as a high quality study. And here under functional assessment, the eccentric intervention group had a greater scores on functional assessment than the control trial. And this is a wait and see control trial. Under health-related quality of life, the eccentric intervention group also had a higher health-related quality of life score, significantly higher than the control group. This study also looked at eccentric exercise as compared to shockwave therapy and found no significant differences between the groups on any of the measures. Ruiz et al., which was ranked as a low-quality study, looked at eccentric intervention or eccentric exercise versus a group doing eccentric exercise with the addition of a night splint, and then eccentric exercise versus a group just doing the night splint, and found that eccentric exercise intervention alone was better than using eccentric exercise with the night splint on pain, as well as better than just using the night splint alone. Next. Okay, so on to results for the patellar tendon. Johnson et al., this one here, which was a low quality study, as we ranked it, had a significant findings for pain. So again, eccentric exercise was better than the comparative treatment, which was a concentric exercise protocol, looking at pain, as well as their functional assessment was significantly better with an eccentric exercise protocol. Purdom et al., which was also a low quality study, their significant findings were for pain. So once again, eccentric exercise did a better job of decreasing level of pain in participants as compared to a comparative treatment. Finally, there was one study that we were able to look at standard mean differences for the wrist extensors. This study was a high quality study, although it was a clinical control trial. They had a number of significant findings here for pain. Their eccentric intervention was better at decreasing pain than their comparative treatment. And their comparative treatment looked at passive rehabilitation modalities such as ice, TENS, ultrasound, deep tendon friction massage, and stretching. They also found that two of their three strength measures were significantly better in the eccentric exercise group. Number two here was a concentric intervention exercise, it was a concentric measure of strength using an isokinetic dynamometer at 90 degrees per second. And the one labeled three is an eccentric contraction at 60 degrees a second. And here under health-related quality of life, the eccentric intervention was significantly better than the comparative passive treatments. So now I'm going to pass it on to Michelle to continue with the results.
Now moving on to the results of our best evidence synthesis. Once again, this tool is used to comment on the strength of our results based on the following criteria. One, statistically significant findings from the calculation of the standard mean difference. And two, the study design of the included articles. As you will see in the next few slides, our systematic review only found limited evidence, indicative findings, and no evidence based on the best evidence synthesis. These categories are defined as the following. Limited evidence. This consists of statistically significant findings and outcome measures in at least one high-quality RCT, or when consistent statistical significant findings and outcome measures are found in at least two high-quality CCTs in the absence of a high-quality RCT. Indicative findings represents statistically significant findings and outcome and/or process measures in at least one high-quality CCT or low-quality RCT, once again in the absence of high-quality RCTs. Lastly, no evidence represents the results of eligible studies that do not meet the criteria of strong, moderate, limited evidence, or indicative findings, or no evidence is reported in the case of conflicting results among RCTs and CTCs. So in our results, we determined the level of evidence for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise compared to various outcome measures for the Achilles, patellar, and wrist extensor tendons. So we'll start with the Achilles tendon. We found limited evidence based on one high-quality RCT for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on functional ability. Again, based on one high-quality RCT, we found limited evidence for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on increasing health-related quality of life when compared to a wait-and-see control group. And we found no evidence to support the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on decreasing pain or increasing strength in the Achilles tendon versus comparative therapies, and this was due to conflicting findings. For the patellar tendon, we found indicative findings for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on pain outcomes over comparative therapies based on one RCT and one CCT. And again, we found indicative findings for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on functional ability versus comparative therapies, and this was based on one RCT. Also, no evidence was found for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on strength when compared to comparative therapies. And lastly, our best evidence synthesis for the results of the wrist extensors, we found indicative findings we found indicative findings that eccentric exercise is effective for improving patient quality of life over other comparative therapies, and no evidence was found for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise on decreasing pain or increasing strength compared to other therapies. And once again, this was due to conflicting findings. So moving on to our discussion, we'll start with the general limitations of our 16 studies. There was multiple issues with the study design of many of our included articles. First, there was intervening variables. Two studies had a concentric component of their eccentric exercise protocol, and four studies had co-interventions allocating to both the eccentric exercise group and the comparative therapy group. And this made it difficult to determine which intervention actually influenced our results. Secondly, there was poor control of the eccentric exercise protocol in many of the studies. For example, monitoring adherence was often not reported, and progression of the load was often based on the patient's subjective perception of pain, minimal pain or no pain. Thirdly, our studies were generally underpowered due to small sample size. Of our 16 articles, 11 included fewer than 50 subjects, thereby limiting our ability to detect significant treatment effects. Also, this small sample size combined with heterogeneous studies, it made it impossible to do a meta-analysis or a subgroup analysis of the data. Fourthly, most studies lack true controls. Eccentric exercise compared to other treatments does not examine the absolute effectiveness of this intervention, and this limits our systematic review findings. And lastly, poor reporting of the data and lack of standardized validated outcome measures limited the scope of our best evidence synthesis, preventing comparisons and weakening our findings. Continuing with our general limitations, we found study quality shortcomings. As we said earlier, we use the Van Tolder criteria to assess study quality, and overall we found these scores to reflect poorly. Often, four components of this tool were not met. One, description of the randomization did not occur. Two, concealment of the treatment allocation. Three, blinding of the outcome assessors. And four, there was a lack of intention to treat analysis. Another general limitation of our studies were the lack of data reported. Only 9 of our 16 studies could be included in our best evidence synthesis, and this left 7 studies not included in the results. Also, we found that there was a lack of generalizability in many of the patient populations, as 8 of our 16 studies used young athletes, as said before. And now, on to Paul.
So I'd like to talk about the actual exercise protocol. Given that the research question concerns the effectiveness of eccentric exercise, obviously it makes sense to employ the most effective eccentric exercise protocol possible. And as mentioned before, there are differences of opinion, first of all, among research as to what this protocol would look like. Probably due to Alfredson's success with his 1998 study on Achilles tendinosis, subsequent studies have largely followed the same protocol. In fact, 9 out of 16 studies used a similar protocol to Alfredson's 98 study. So in general, this was twice a day, 7 days a week, 3 times 15 repetitions over a 12-week intervention. Now, as Michelle had mentioned earlier, there were some variation in terms of how different studies addressed pain and also progression. So they did vary from Alfredson's protocol in terms of those two criteria. Alfredson's protocol does lack a scientific underpinning and is based on clinical practice. Other researchers have also received good results with protocols that vary from Alfredson's. For instance, Quezier et al., 2007, their study achieved very good results for the common wrist extensor with a frequency of just 3 times a week. In this study, they argue that a rest period is actually necessary for tendon recovery. And there are similar questions regarding exercise protocol in terms of pain. For Alfredson, this is a crucial aspect of his protocol. However, Kerwin and Stanish achieved good results in patellar tendinopathy with painless drop squats, where speed is progressed prior to load. Also, both studies that we looked at that addressed the common wrist extensors argued for painless protocols. Both Quessier et al. And Martinez Silvestrini, the authors of those studies, maintain that training into pain can both cause injury and decrease compliance. So in terms of clinical relevance, despite the lack of strong, statistically significant results in favor of eccentric exercise, the majority of studies do show a positive trend in favor of it. Clinicians have to weigh this evidence against the general lack of evidence in favor of alternative treatments. Those clinicians choosing to employ eccentric exercise interventions based on the research should consider whether the subjects that they are treating match or are representative of the subjects in the studies. As mentioned earlier, this is particularly true when looking at patellar tendinopathy, where the subjects tend to be young, elite volleyball players. In addition, clinicians should consider whether their patients will be as motivated or as capable of following the prescribed exercise interventions as the athletes considered in many of these studies. In terms of future research design, as addressed by Michelle, there are many study design issues that could be addressed in future research, and I don't plan to repeat them here. The use of consistent and validated outcome measures would go a long way towards strengthening results and permitting statistical comparisons and the pooling of data between studies. Achieving larger sample sizes, whether by multi-center trials or other means, would help to reveal statistically significant differences between groups that are clinically relevant. Also, larger studies would permit subgroup analysis, allowing researchers to detect differences between subgroups based on factors such as age, sex, activity levels, biomechanical faults, and duration or severity of symptoms. So this would help tease out the role of these different factors. In addition, long-term follow-up would be important to determine the long-term benefits of eccentric exercise. Moving on to future research topics. Future research may provide a clear understanding of the physiological effect by which eccentric exercise impacts tendinosis. Some important questions could be, does this vary by tendon? What are the implications of this on exercise prescription? What is an optimal exercise prescription? In general, clinicians agree that intrinsic and extrinsic factors are important contributors to tendinosis, but there's no evidence to support this. So by intrinsic, we're talking about age, gender, biomechanics, and genetics. Extrinsic factors would be environment, physical load, and training errors. So does correction of these factors impact healing? And if so, how? Much has been learned about the pathophysiology of tendinosis, but much remains to be learned. How do tendons differ? Why is the patellar tendon resistant to healing? Why is lateral epicondylar tendinopathy often self-limiting? These are some of the questions that could be addressed in future research. So in conclusion, this review demonstrates that there's a lack of well-designed, high-quality studies providing limited evidence to support the clinical effectiveness of eccentric exercise over other conservative treatments and the rehabilitation of tendinosis. We would like to thank Dr. Linda Lee and Charlotte Beck. Thank you very much. And in fact, Linda Lee, if you would mind coming down. Dr. Lee, if you'd mind coming. Oh, yeah, after the questions. If you could just please hold on. Stay in your seat. Don't jump up. But after the questions, we'd like you to come down, and we have something for you. So now questions. And yesterday, last night, was fireworks, if you didn't hear it. It's fireworks night. Who has the first question?
Nobody asked. I will have to ask something. Well, I want to congratulate you guys. I think I learn as much from you guys as much as you learn from me. In your work, did you find any other reveals that is similar to yours? And if so, how's your result compared to what's existing out there?
Okay, well, we found one other systematic review that searched the evidence for all the tendons and the effect of eccentric exercise. And this just came out in the last 6 months or so while we were doing our project. It was kind of disappointing, but they only researched RCTs, and we decided we were going to hope to do a subgroup analysis by incorporating CCTs into ours. When we looked at the research, we couldn't do that, which was a disappointment. But our results were the same in the fact that there is limited evidence for the effectiveness of eccentric exercise. But what else can I say? Yeah. But we did have a few more articles, a few more RCTs of them, because just in the last few years, this is a hot topic, and it seems that people are producing more research. So we're hoping for more high quality stuff to be coming.
Aren't randomized controlled trials usually supposed to be high quality? So they rank so low, and one of your reasons was lack of randomization. Is that only the clinical control trial that lack of randomization?
No.
How can a randomized control trial lack
randomization? Well, description of randomization.
Description.
Yeah, so it may say it's randomized, but you have no way of knowing how or how well it's randomized. Is it done properly?
Yeah. A lot of the problems, maybe just a comment, was lack of reporting of all sorts of different things. They don't go into many descriptions, so you kind of have to take their word. They tell you it's randomized, but they don't actually say the method. And one of the criteria Van Tulder, they want to know how it's, like, there has to be a description. So that's a reason, and that happened in numerous different variables. People just aren't reporting enough information is what we found.
Okay.
So from a clinician's perspective and not a researcher's, can you tell me what the difference is between a CCT and an RCT?
There you want that one.
No, you go ahead.
Better than I
I'll tell you.
We do know. We're going to pause and flip a coin. Yeah. So. Randomized control trial. So all subjects are randomized usually, and there's usually a control that can vary as to what a control is classified as. And clinical control trial doesn't necessarily have to be randomized.
So that's the only difference.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's why I gave it to her. She knows.
Can I ask another question? Those seven studies, I think, that you had where they didn't provide enough data, were you not able to use those at all in your findings, and you were down to the nine studies?
Because we decided to do a standard mean difference, we had to have similar outcome measurements, and a lot of studies varied, or for the most part, a lot of studies didn't report their standard deviation, which you require to do the standard mean difference. So either they didn't report anything in tabular form, they just used graphs, so we couldn't estimate off the graph. So it was interesting to see, because I come from a different science, like a biological science background, to see the reporting of results was inconsistent. So,
and just to add to that, in the paper that we wrote, we were sort of able to summarize what the trends were based on those studies that we couldn't calculate the standard mean difference. Unfortunately, you sort of have to take the researcher's word at that point, for they're saying that they're finding a positive effect, but if the numbers aren't there to take a look at it yourself, you just have to take their word for it. So, and I think, if I remember correctly, in some of the studies that we weren't able to calculate, there were a lot of positive trends toward eccentric exercise interventions being better than some of the other comparative treatments, but we had to take their word for that.
And if I could just add one more thing, it seems like a lot of our studies actually looked at patient satisfaction, which is interesting from the clinical perspective, but it's not that great when you're trying to manipulate the data and you can't really get a standard mean difference on that. But there was a lot of positive patient satisfaction results, which we have in our paper.
You're nodding at me. Did any of the interventions use the Kerwin and Standish protocol?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But the Alfredson seems to be the newer.
The new one kid on the block.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we looked at later in the past couple of days, Alfredson is co-author on many of the studies.
Yeah.
So hence,
sort of the last author there.
Yeah, I think two of his studies, he was the first author, but he's the last author on numerous studies. So a lot of research is coming out of that lab, which is another potential problem.
And did you come across a wonderful single subject study done by DuMont at all?
We did.
It was wonderful.
It was on our list.
It was wonderful.
Unfortunately,
that would be DuMont, McKenzie, and Harris.
Yeah.
McIntyre. But it was excluded because
we looked at some of the references in it, though.
But yeah, we did find some single studies that actually looked at the rotator cuff. Which would have been nice to include because we're trying to get a broad idea of all tendons in the body, but they didn't meet our criteria.
Right. Well, another great presentation. Thank you.
So,
one more.
Well, just before we go, if we could just bring Linda down, just we have a small token of thanks.
Thank you.
Because she was a great supervisor.
Thanks,
oh, it was.
Thank you.
Thank you.